Welcome to the Not Sorry Art Podcast. I'm Sari Shrike, the artist and creator behind Not Sorry Art. I'm so excited to talk art and creativity with you, so grab a drink, grab a snack, and let's dive in. I also wanted to say that today's episode is sponsored by my book. I have a book coming out. I'm so proud of this, guys. The links are already up. I'll have them in the show notes. But the book is called Modern Still Life, From Fruit Bowls to Disco Balls. It is my take on a step-by-step painting book. I am really excited about it. Not only does it have like motivational tips and tricks to keep you going in your practice, but it also has clear and beautiful and full color breakdowns of the step-by-step process in my paintings. So I could not be more excited about it. If you wanted to check it out, pre-order it. It would help me more than you even know. Hello and welcome back to the Not Sorry Art Podcast. I'm Sari. Thanks for being here. I'm excited for y'all to hear my discussion today with Megan E. Collins for part two of our summer book club series. For July, we read Your Brain on Art, How the Arts Transform Us by Susan Magsman and Ivy Ross. This book, published just last year, is a fascinating peek into the science of neuroaesthetics and how art impacts our lives in myriad ways. I hope you enjoy our conversation and stay tuned for the third and final installment of the Summer Book Club series next month as we discuss Bianca Bosker's new book, Get the Picture, a firsthand account of an outsider's journey into the art world and beyond. Thank you so much for our time and enjoy the show. Hi, Megan. Welcome back. I'm so excited to talk to you today, our second iteration of the Summer Book Club series. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to talk about this book.
Yes. And I think exciting is the right word, especially in contrast to last month's book, which I think is important. But I think in a lot of ways, this is the other side of the coin to like the reality of kind of the art world and aesthetics. But this book is really grounded in the science of neuroaesthetics. So before, I want to hear your thoughts. Before I jump in, I think it's helpful to catch everyone up in case you didn't read the book all the way. I think you can still glean a lot from this episode. But the book is called Your Brain on Art, and it's co-written by two women. One of them is Ivy Ross, who is an artist, and she also works at Google as like a product designer. And then Susan Magsman, who is a neuroaesthetic scientist and researcher at Johns Hopkins. And they co-collaborated on this book. So it's like a mixture between an art background and a science background. And it was very interesting. But neuroaesthetics, I found myself having to Google it because I needed a few different definitions before I launched into this. But basically, it's the study of how your surroundings, and it can be everything from art to smell to nature, affects your neurology, your brain, your sense of being in a measurable, scientifically ground sort of way. That being said, I'm curious, Megan, right at the top, like, how was this book for you? Did you enjoy it? What are your feelings?
Yeah, I absolutely loved this book. I thought it was just so thought-provoking and interesting. And I think it does something that I aspire to do in my work, which is kind of like make the kind of very complex social interactions that are kind of inarticulable, kind of back them in data. And I've been working at YouTube for the past 3 years, and it's a very data-driven company. So the way that she talks about like the data and bringing it always back to like, why is this so great that we can validate this with data, I thought was like very Google and very cool. And I think that I see the value of how that's going to like change a lot of hearts and minds about why art is important. However, I did sometimes feel like it was like, well, yeah, duh. Like it was like, we found like that we were able to see that like Cirque du Soleil inspired awe 70% of the time. And it's like, duh, like, did you really need like to build a model to tell you that like it was impressive and that people had a response that they were impressed to this? So I think it's very cool that we're studying this and that we're quantifying all of this stuff and being able to measure it. But at the same time, sometimes I'm like, you're just validating things that we already know to be human truths. But like I said, working at Google, working at YouTube, I know that that's important in a capitalistic society to be able to tie those human truths back to numbers and the bottom line and science. And so I really appreciate what this book is doing.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. And I feel like having this, like, I think, yeah, you're pointing to a point where it's like the perpetual exhaustion of having to like back up what should be like a fairly known like entity. But I mean, I think to get to the setting, You know, we think about the conversation around like why is art important in school and how it's often, you know, art and humanities are the first things that are cut in school. And so, you know, I think it's a book of its time in that we're finally, I think, getting around to like making like a concrete argument that appeals to people who would say that there's no A in STEM, right? There's this idea of like there's STEAM and STEM, and STEM, science, technology. And basically, STEAM adds art to that equation and says that art is one of these. And it's funny because as an artist, I see this conversation all the time, and people are always like, art isn't part of it, aesthetic isn't part of it. Like, it has nothing to do like with, you know, there's this idea, especially when there's like a perceived or real scarcity in the world, that we can forego sort of these aesthetic things, whether it's art, formal or like embellishment, niceties, and good design, outside time, longer recesses, however that manifests. And there's this idea that that's somehow frivolous or lesser. A lot of it, I think, is very rooted in sexism. Last year, we read the book Chromophobia, where it talked about a lot of aesthetic things being seen as like superficial, like the makeup on top of the actual meat and potatoes of what we're dealing with. But this book, I think, argues that it's actually part of it. And I think, to your point, yeah, Cirque du Soleil inspiring awe, of course. And so, in a lot of ways, it felt, yeah, totally. It basically, I'm grateful for the book, but it felt sad that you have to argue in this day and age that art is really important.
Well, I had something to add on what you were saying about STEAM and including art. And I think that that's kind of the point that we're at in technology. And when you think about like the platforms and the social media platforms and the next iteration of tech, and they talk about this in the book too, is like immersive experience and mixed media. And that is such an aesthetic, art-driven experience for the consumer. And so much of like research right now in tech is like, how is the consumer interacting with this? And like, it's the inarticulable things because people don't want to come online and do homework. It's really like the Steve Jobs model of like, it's intuitive, it just feels right, and you don't have to like learn how to use the technology. And so we're in this era where the STEM, science, tech, engineering, and math need to have an understanding of aesthetics and appreciation for aesthetics in order to build for this next iteration of what technology needs to be relevant to humans.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I wonder if you could, if you feel comfortable expanding. I know you mentioned having a past working at YouTube, you know, YouTube and Google. I think YouTube is owned by Google. Is that right? They're like
Yes,
part of the
correct. Yeah.
same thing. I'm curious because I think that's always really illuminating. Because, you know, I come to art and design kind of from the standpoint of like art is for everybody, it's for us, it's for the people. And one thing you see, I think, in your job, and you know, I'd love to hear your insight on this, is at the highest level, whether you like it or not, whether you think it should be in elementary school or not, like it is a part of any, well, you know, any modern tactic around STEM or technologies or algorithms or interfaces. And I'm curious if you could sort of, you know, expand on how it's being used and like what are the questions about, you know, art and aesthetics in these like higher level industries?
Yeah, I think I can't really speak to like the work specifically because it's proprietary, but I think even just like talking about the book and like chapter one, for instance, they have this story about this Google project that they did where they had all of these rooms, and feel free to like, if I'm not explaining this
No, you're
correctly,
great. Yeah.
interrupt me, but they had all of these different rooms of featuring different forms of art. And then they had people go through and they were reading their biometric data of like how they're responding to each of the rooms and which one they deemed like the best, or I don't think best was the word that they used,
Yeah, like
but
we're they were me measuring their brainwaves to see what they responded to. So pleasure versus like excitement, boredom, interest, biomarkers, I think is what they called it. But they were able to sort of see people's, you know, they reported one thing at the end, but they were able to look into their brain and see how they were like reacting sort of more emotionally to the rooms.
yeah, and they said they have one journalist who's, I'll just read from the book. It says, Rab Messina, a design journalist, wrote about the surprising disconnect between her conscious thoughts as she walked through the exhibition and what was later revealed to be her body's biodata. And so it talks about how she had been mesmerized by the first and last rooms, which she saw high, sophisticated design, while in the middle room with vibrant colors and books made her want to flee. Yet, while in that room, her biofeedback was inarguably the most at ease. why would my body equate ease with dislike? So she was in one room that she was like, this is not the best room, but that was the room where she felt the most at ease. And then later, the conclusion they draw is that while I could lie to myself about my own sense of belonging, the data didn't. And kind of this idea of like the data tells the truth. But I think that there's kind of like a missing link there and kind of like a jump that was made in that all the data did was expose her like the dissonance, but she had to do that self-reflection of like, why is that dissonance there? And, you know, come to this like, it's like a post-colonial, like, I interpret like my things that are comfortable to me as being other and not seen as accepted by like the white aspirational class. So she's kind of trained herself to be like, this is not safe. And so even though she's like at most at ease in that room, that's what the one she knows is the least acceptable to society. So I question how much credit we're giving to the data to like exposing that insight, because it required that like layer of journalistic like reflection and emotionality. And I think where Google struggles from my diagnostic perspective is attributing too much to that data and saying like the data shows. And so I think that where we're at with this creative class and like where I think apps like TikTok are doing really well is responding more to those human things that are inarticulable, but are helping us uncover these like deeper insights about things that we might care about.
That's a good point, because you could look at that and the takeaway could be, oh, it was a, kind of a self-reinforcing sort of cycle of like, that's the stem of it all. When in reality, the art, the introspection, the self-awareness, and the acknowledgement of systems that maybe exist outside of data or that data hasn't fully caught up to is just as much, if not the more important part of the work. Because you can have all the data in the world, but how you apply it, think about it, and digest it is the relationship, the real meat and potatoes of that. I'm so glad you brought up that chapter and that point, because I can remember the first time I read this, I think earlier in the year, at the end of last year, I like stopped and re-listened to that whole section like two or three times. And I think I recorded it, make a TikTok about it. Like, it was very profound, because as someone who wheels and deals in art and thinks a lot about it, and even like color bias and things like that. I mean, it's just, I thought that that was a really, and I don't know, just important aspect of the book for me. I gleaned a lot from that. I think your breakdown of it is pretty helpful with that. I'm wondering if anyone else really enjoyed that chapter, because I think that, what she's pointing out, and like what to your point, what you were saying is like the data provides the, the talking points or the jumping off point of an important conversation. The points that she made, I would read as an entire book in and of itself, of people working in aesthetics and why is there this one aesthetic that we're held to. And in the book kind of continues, I mean, not to that point, but making a point of the importance of aesthetics and the importance of our relationship and our emotions with the relationship between art and aesthetics and sound and all of those things. So I don't know. I thought it was a good leaping off point in the book, because as someone who works in, communicating to the public, it was a fantastic pain point that I know pulled me way into the book.
Yeah, and I think also sets up this idea of like our thoughts versus our feelings, and the idea that they can be separate. And while they're informed by each other in this like unconscious part of our brain, like I think that's something they say at some point of like how we're only using a small percentage of our brain. And lately, people have been asking me, like, how do I do what I do? And so I've had to like kind of reflect on that beyond just like the idea of like, you know, I read a lot, watch a lot, and digest it all. But I think it's also this idea of like, I trust that other percentage of my brain that I'm not, that I don't have access to, that it's doing what I want it to be doing and is giving me like the right signals. And I think I've also, so like in a situation like that, because I kind of trained myself, I feel like I could go through a room like that and kind of understand that I felt most at ease at, in that room, even though my thoughts thought that this room was the best, because I've kind of like done that exercise within my own self. And like, there's a lot of things throughout this book that they were talking about that I was like, oh, like this is something that I just started doing one day. And it makes sense that, like, I've trained my brain to kind of have just like a perspective, because it's not possible for me to remember everything or like have an opinion on everything, but if I'm just taking in all the inputs at once, and then when my brain, when like I kind of have a spark or a feeling to something, I'm like, there's something here that needs to be investigated. And that's like always to me felt really like woo-woo and like, oh, this isn't real, like intuition. But now I'm like, no, this is the other percentage of my brain picking up on things that I don't have access to in my frontal lobe right now, but that doesn't mean that it's not based in science and fact and reason. It's just reason that I'm not privy to at the current moment, you know?
Yeah, I completely am nodding vigorously because as a visual artist, that is something I deal with all the time. I mean, really, it's such a trust, an activity of trust with yourself and building up of confidence. And I think that at its core, not to condense art to anything, so much of art is confidence. And I don't mean confidence is like shoulders back kind of confidence, but I mean like an ability to trust that your little limited amount of data that exists in sort of that left part of your brain that can like verbalize it into words and can go back and find the sources. That little chunk of knowledge is going to reach the part of your brain that doesn't have the language for it, which is a great jumping off point for a part of the book that talks about the part of why there's so much power in the arts is because we, especially in our modern sort of model for like therapy, a lot of times, especially like cognitive behavioral therapy and things like that, we rely on the ability to translate what we're thinking into language. And I know personally for me, like as someone who's struggled with dyslexia and like, had to really work on good speech and like conveying myself as part of my job. But before that, like part of why I gravitated towards art is because I felt like there was so much of me that my words just like it felt flat. Like there's this like famous old meme of someone with like a cartoon of all the things they're thinking, and then what comes out of their mouth is like a fraction, and it's like black and white and just not good at all. But part of my, I think, draw to art was I was able to experience and feel so much that I just couldn't convey or even think about properly to myself. And I think as I've developed an art practice and developed that trust and developed a whole way of thinking and processing that has nothing to do with language necessarily, like it's just, I mean, I don't have, to my point, great words for it, but it's just like really fulfilled me like as a human and just given me so much confidence. And it's so something I'm so passionate about that it kind of it's like underwrites my whole like philosophy around like my parenting style and how I encourage people to make art, good or bad. You access a part of yourself that isn't, part of that language part of your brain. And they talk about it in the book as like your language center.
Yeah, and I think that I feel like I think similarly to that, where the way I talk about it is like I'm not thinking in words, I'm thinking in pictures, images, videos, feelings, experiences, and then I have to find the words to to talk about them and like be like, you've chosen art, I've chosen words, and like I was obsessed with books as a kid, and like I really like I'm always talking about word connotation. Like when I'm giving edits, I'm like, well, this word it has a better connotation for what you're actually trying to say. And I think that's similar to color theory of like, this color is like hitting on the right hue or the right tone or the right vibrancy that you're trying to, and it's about like hitting the wave the right way. Yeah. So in the book, they talk about a concept being something that you can literally grasp. And I think that this is something that, like, again, to that point of like, I think I've just really like trained my brain. I know when something has clicked for me and when it has not. And like, there's a moment where like something clicks, and this happened the most for me in math class. And there would just be times where like something just wasn't clicking, and I just like needed it. Like, and I would go to somebody else and be like, can you describe this to me? Because the way that it's being described by the teacher is not working. And then it would click. And this idea of like a concept is something that you have to grasp, I think is like really interesting to me as like a more visual thinker, because I don't like just reading the words. I have to like, there has to be like a different brain process to help me actually like grab onto the concept and hold on to it. And I think that there are many ways to grasp a concept. And I think art's one of them, words are one of them. And I think that part of why I've gotten good at my job is because my job is just essentially helping people grasp concepts about youth culture, essentially. And like the various ways that I can help people do that and grasp these concepts, and words are one of them. Sometimes it's video. And so I just really like this idea of like all of these things are not truth or fiction or real or not, but kind of just like us attempting to meaning make from the world around us. And all of these things are just sensory inputs that help us grasp these concepts that we need to survive, whether that's like these berries are not safe to eat, or now we're something more complicated, like, what the internet is. And so, yeah. And even like to what you were saying about like being able to use art to articulate how you're feeling, that was something they talked about in the book of like a child with anxiety and how he went to art therapy and he drew a family portrait, and in where his stomach was, he drew like squiggles or something. And then they were able to like figure out through that he had didn't have the words to describe anxiety because it's such an existential, weird concept. And that's something that I'm always amazed with, like parents and the things that you have to teach children, like
Oh my
concepts
God.
that we just take for granted, that we just like understand. And then I'm talking to my friends who have kids, and they're like, so we're really working on like personal space. And I'm like, the idea that you would have to teach someone the concept of personal space is just so interesting to me, you know? And so, again, I forgot my train of thought, but.
No, you're good. I love it. No, I mean, like taking something slippery and turning it into something graspable. I mean, it's tough. I mean, to your credit, like when you just, I love when you describe your job because it is the creative process to a T. And what I love about that is I think we're getting better at it, but like the idea of creativity being like paintbrush or ballet or, these really stiff kind of, I think, incredibly outdated concepts of what is art. I think when you talk about your job, it's practical because it's your profession, but it is the creative process. And I think it's one of those things where whether or not you ever become good at painting, good at, I mean, air quotes here, but like you match society's expectation of what is good to the point of it being a profession. Whether or not you get there, it helps you to think. I mean, even like you were just saying with like people describing thoughts to kids, like that requires so much creativity to be able to, because you have to take into account, okay, this person, this is too traumatic to tell them all the way up here, this amount of higher thinking, but I can offer it in this way. And a lot of times you have to come up with analogies. And it is that like that creative thinking that makes your life so much, it doesn't stress you out. You know that you can convey it and then you can live life and point out like, oh, that's an example of personal space. Or, it's this ongoing creative, I think, act that it doesn't stop at an easel and it doesn't stop at your profession. It just is something that like there's so many benefits to taking on, whether it's gardening, humming, singing, dancing, painting, and how much it can expand and better so much of your life.
Yeah, and I think that one of my takeaways from reading this book was that this, like, the commodification of everything and this idea that, like, art has to be a product is kind of the, like, big issue right now. And I think even one that I would, like, press the authors of this book on, and even something like I always talk about with my colleagues of, like, we have to think about the whole creative process of making a video, not just the video itself. So, like, when you're trying to encourage people to make like shorts and short form video, they're really often only thinking about the final product because we work at YouTube and that's what we see. But I'm like, but there's like so much that goes into this. And even I think empathy is really important here. One thing that I was like, when shorts was first starting and we were really trying to like get more people to create on shorts, I was like always kind of like surprised by the types of things that they would suggest that we do. And then I said, you know what? I think the executives need to make shorts. I think they need to go make a short and like learn a dance, post it, and show it to everybody. And I think they will understand like what it's like. And so the next time they had a retreat, they did just that. They made shorts and they did the Beyonce Cuff It dance. And they came back with a newfound empathy for what it's like to put yourself out there, to make short form video, and to understand. And I think empathy is so important and something that we have lost a little bit in this process because of commodification of everything. But it is so important to put yourself into the shoes of people who are going to be on the receiving end of whatever you're saying. And I think parenthood is the ultimate exercise in empathy. And that's why it kind of like inspires you to like do that level of creative exercise around like teaching this person how to view the world. But I think empathy is super important and something that's missing. And actually, one of the questions I wanted to ask you, because I thought you would have an answer for this, is do you remember when you discovered empathy, like as a concept, and grasp it? Because I remember when I did.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to like mull this over for a couple of days because I think I could give you a better answer. But I do remember a pivotal moment of empathy. It's kind of dark. I feel, well, okay. I mean, maybe I was younger than this, but I remember my mom and dad had a really hard fight with each other, which I'm glossing over some details. And my dad had been like very clearly like a boogeyman in my life, scared of him, whatever, just to keep it simple. And I remember he was about to leave the house for a while for whatever reason. And he was like crying. And it was like I remember being like having this like weird emotion of like, he doesn't like want to be the bad guy kind of moment. I can still picture him like at the table and like exactly what was going on. And I don't know if that was like my first moment of empathy necessarily, but I think it was like an important moment where like it is just as a kid, it was just so much easier to be like, mom is good guy, dad is bad guy. And that was like my life. It was very simple, very Disney movie. And then having this like, I wanted to cry for him, but then I wanted to cry for like the whole thing kind of feeling that came over me. And my mom being like, well, you're the only kid that feels empathy for your dad, and having to like unpack that. But anyways, but that's when I think of like a pivotal moment of empathy, I think of that moment. I would have been pretty young, like elementary school, but I don't think like primary school, like early, if that helps. Is that a good answer?
Yeah, that's a very profound, and I relate to that a lot. And yeah, thank you for sharing that. Mine's a little more lighthearted. It was
I hope so. I'm sorry. I was like, that's all I could think of.
Oh,
I'll
no,
give you
I
better
love
answers.
it. I love it. I think that that's exactly like what I'm talking about, of like having that feeling and like grasping it in your mind of like, this is strange that like my feeling can be at odds with what I know to be true in my head. Mine was when I was watching, I think it was either Cinderella or Stuart Little, and I said to my mom, I was like, isn't it interesting how like we don't like mice, but when we're watching these types of shows and movies, they make us care about the mice. Like I was like, if a white mouse, for instance, Stuart Little ran in here right now, we would be freaked out and we would want to be
Like
exterminated.
squash him.
But
Yeah.
we're
Oh.
like watching a whole long movie rooting for this mouse to be adopted into this family. And I was like, isn't it really interesting how like putting us in the perspective of the mouse makes us on the mouse's side?
Yeah.
And that was like me discovering empathy for the first time,
I
of like
love
how
that.
it yeah, how it could be like putting yourself and how perspective was so important to empathy. And
Yeah, and
that's what I
like
thought. What
backstory. No, that's so smart. That's such a like smart kid thing. And I can tell you, like, as a parent, like if my kid came to me with that, I would like cry forever in a good way. Like it's so sweet. Like I want to get back to your story, but briefly, like I've been talking to Knox forever about reading the room and the ability to read a room. And we haven't had that conversation in several months. And then I had to tell my younger child sort of read the room at one point. Obviously, it didn't mean anything. She's too young. But and then I asked Knox, like, can you explain what, do you know what read the room means? Because he kind of said it and then he like articulated it perfectly. And it was like one of those like proud moments because they're people, they have like the bigger emotions.
Yeah.
But it's so sweet that you were able to see that like context. And maybe, I mean, obviously, maybe you didn't have the words exactly, but like understanding this little mouse backstory and being able to, even though we don't relate to him being a vermin, a critter, we relate to like his story and he wants parents and like kids, like your main MO in your brain until you're, a teenager is I need to make sure that I am attached to my parents because my survival hinges upon it, right? Like so much of our brain as little kids is hinged on that. And so a kid's biggest motivation and need is projected onto this thing that's often the enemy, the bad guy, scary. I would be afraid of a little mouse. All of a sudden it like was like a paradigm shift for you. I think that's so interesting. That's really sweet. It makes me want to go watch Stuart Little because it's been probably like 2 decades.
Well, and I think that's like the importance of storytelling and art, and something that I've been reflecting on as I like revisit art and like childhood things, is how much like feminism and like pro-socialism was actually in a lot of the like 90s and early 2000s cartoons and stuff. And like when you look back, it was like really intentional, and like some of the people who were doing those things are now like the tops in their fields. And I'm like, this is really cool that they were able to put some like universally agreed upon messages in these children's shows so that I was able to grasp these concepts before they were made controversial to me. You know what I
Yes,
mean?
100%. And it reminds me of the conversation that I hear every once in a while about,
why are all these people in Hollywood so progressive, so liberal, whatever? And my answer is always like, they're artists. Like they engage, like their craft is like empathy for money. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not saying that all celebrity or certainly not all actors are good necessarily, but like, especially in a world where the bar is incredibly low for which party exhibits empathy, like it's a bummer that you can say, hey, I don't want kids to get hurt in school, and you know who you're voting for. But anyways, but it's the idea that, yeah, of course, like people who engage in empathy as part of their craft are going to be able to have a modicum of more empathy than maybe the average American. And it's just, anyways, yeah, 100% art is empathy. I think in the book that at one point they say art is hope. I wish I wrote down exactly where it was, but it was really important. The context was really nice. It was basically, a layup to the fact that art is all of these things, but the highest form of art, I think is what they said, is hope. And I think hope is nothing if not an act in empathy. Empathy for yourself, empathy for humanity. Like you have to be able to creatively say, like, there is a path out, because doomerism is seductive and it's limited thinking and it's looking at the reality of what you have now and just continuing that prediction into a negative outcome, where the ability to take what's going on and to say that we can do like earned hope, earned optimism, not just like, I'm not going to look at the problem and hope it goes away, but like earned optimism is an act of empathy and hope altogether. And I mean, I think that's, when I get down to it, not to show too much of my ulterior motives here, but part of why I'm always driving home why I want people to do art isn't necessarily because I think having more stuff to hang on walls is going to move the needle. But I think what it does is when you are an artist, your capacity for hope, whether it's political, personal, your own relationships, your relationship with yourself, I think you become primed for such a better experience, especially because we just get such a little snippet of time on this planet. It's so much better when you have the capacity for that kind of realistic hope for yourself and everything you come into contact with.
And I think chapter 6 of the book is about flourishing. And I think that that's so tied to hope and like kind of what you were saying. And they talk about this man, I can't remember his name, but they said that he was a natural flourisher and is kind of this idea of like whatever situation he was put in, he would like try to make it better and like make the, and I feel like I found myself, I would say I'm the same. Like I try to just make the best of the situation and like I am like really grateful for everything that I have in life and that I'm super privileged and like, I have all my needs met and stuff. But I also know that like if I didn't have as much as I do, I would make do. And like I would find the best of the situation and like I would, still form connections with my community and like want to be a kind person and like all of these things. And so that hope that you're talking about in the flourishing chapter like really stood out to me. And also this idea that they had of like being curious, I think is like one of the things of an artist is just like wanting to explore the things that you don't know. And it's like I think that's very vulnerable curiosity. And in my line of work specifically, you would be surprised how there's a lack of curiosity because people want to have all the answers. So you'll get things where like you'll say, have you heard of this thing? And then everybody's like, yeah, I've heard of it. And then it's because the idea that you haven't heard of something is like, oh, you're behind the times and I'm ahead of you, and kind of
That's
like
easy.
a very neurotypical like kind of like status thing. But I think one of the reasons that I love my job and have been successful at it is I'm like, I haven't heard of that thing. Please tell me about it. And like I would love your perspective on it and tell me everything you know and just like being really curious instead of like, oh yeah, I know everything, and just being like, I don't know everything, and I would be eager to hear from people who know better than me. And that like stance of curiosity, I think, is part of why I've been able to flourish, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. And I love that you brought that up about curiosity, because I think a lot of times our relationship with curiosity is we watch Curious George as a kid, and it just means, and then you keep going. Gosh, you know what? There's even that phrase, curiosity killed the cat, which is, oh my gosh, so gross now that I think of it.
Yeah.
Like, it's the worst. Oh my gosh. But no, but I think the thing about curiosity too that scares people is like, it's like when you're in your yard, and like my kids love doing this thing where we just turn over rocks and we just see what's under it, and it's like critters and stuff. It's a pastime of ours. Anyways, but there is a little bit of fear every time we turn over a
Okay,
rock.
but how is that different than scrolling the TikTok FYP?
Well, because you could find something you don't like, you could find something
You
that
could.
keeps you
You could
safe and
do.
is, or you could find something that makes you reconsider your worldview. And that's scary to a lot of people.
Yeah. No, I'm saying it's a good thing that like you're basically doing the IRL version of like scrolling the FYP, and that's kind of like something I took throughout this book of like they're prescribing things, but it's like really you're just prescribing that people go out and live life, you know, and like
Yeah.
go and flip rocks essentially.
Yeah, and I think that it brings me back to kind of like some of my bigger points of view of the book is, you know, that one of my big talking points that I'm like, I want to either write into a book or like do something more concrete with. And I think I've mentioned this, so I'll be quick, but you know, my background is like as an athlete, then artist, I always think. And so exercise has been really helpful for me in the sense of like going out and just like physically being in my body has been helpful because I can get really in my brain. And especially if you've ever experienced any trauma, the book even talks about it, that can be a bit of a conflict. And whether you're embodying through going on a walk or yoga or stretching or being embodied by making artwork, you know, tomato, tomato to me at this point. But the idea being that, like, when I think back at the history of exercise, at least within the West, and specifically running to make my point, prior to about the 1970s, it would have been kind of weird if you were not either a student who was on a running team or like an elite athlete who was like training for like the Olympics or something to go around your neighborhood jogging. Certainly, if you were like a woman, like a mom, you know, there's even a plot point in Mad Men where like one of the neighbors is deemed as crazy, I'm using air quotes, because she goes on morning walks and runs. Anyways, but there's this idea that like up until this point, we're at a point in history where physical exercise or physical movement, I'll say, had been largely mined out of people's lives, where prior to like certain points in the Industrial Revolution, like to go out and sort of work in the field and, you know, whatever. I'm not romanticizing it, but what I'm trying to say is that it was a little more creativity and physical movement were sort of more part of people's lives. And when they were mined out of it, we had to sort of reintroduce those things, well, under capitalism as products. So it was running shoes. But then we sort of got to this point where you didn't have to be the top, you know, you didn't have to be professional or a student in order to enjoy exercise. And now it's no big deal if you're, let's say, a mom again, who's like had a baby and wants to get back into moving and walking and running, and you have someone watch your kid while you go exercise. Everyone would be like, oh, that's great. It's great for your health. And obviously, there's probably other things to do with it, but largely, there's a belief that like physical movement is important to someone's humanity to the point where we don't care if you're good at it. And I think we're on the precipice of something similar happening with creativity, where we're slowly moving away from you have to be so good that you're a professional, or you have to be a student, admitting that you're a student, that you could be like, no, I do this every week, I do this all the time, and I'm still at this like not great level, which is all very subjective. And I think we're seeing like the final fits of it. And the last thing I'll say on this is there's like a moment on TikTok where this person made a wedding painting and everyone thought it was naive or bad.
Oh
Did you
my
see that?
gosh, I have been dying for your take on this.
Makes me so angry. No, and the thing is that
I knew you would be anti that everyone shaming her, to be clear,
of
but I wanted to
course.
hear exactly what you had to say.
Of course. I mean, here's the thing though. If you're even if you're
I
like,
feel
oh, go ahead. I want to hear your thought.
sorry, I was just gonna say, I think I equate this to when they were like, we're raising the minimum wage, and I saw a lot of people complaining, like, well, I'm a nurse and they're gonna be making as much, and I'm like, you should be making more. Like, if
Yeah.
you see that this woman is getting $900 for this painting and you feel like you could do 10 times better, charge 10 times more than she's charging.
Yeah.
Like,
Yes. A
okay,
hundred
sorry.
percent. It's
I want to hear your take
no,
though.
perfectly said. 100%. It's scarcity. It's scarcity because we're all creative. You know what I mean? In the same way that like all of us were like, hey, like turns out walking around your neighborhood makes you feel better. And then of course the science eventually caught up and was like, it's good for you. And we're all like, we already knew. But
Exactly.
like this book is. But
Yes.
yeah, 100%. I think, and also to the cutthroat point, like as an artist, like my boss is the market. So if the market says it's worth something, it's worth something. So like, you know, regardless of what you think, if someone can sell it for it, it's worth it. But yeah, I mean, this idea that like you're holding, and I will say that I actually want to make a longer video on it because I think there's a conversation there around the perception of meritocracy is how it's sold to the middle classes and a relationship between skill and talent, but it's a whole other can of worms. But yeah, to make it really succinct, you're totally right. It's a scarcity thing. It's a we all should be creative thing. And when people have to push away their own talents and interests and skills and aptitudes for a life that the creativity has been largely mined out of, I think, of course, you're going to see any variation of frustration and scarcity and anger and discontentment, doomerism, I think, from people. It makes sense. I don't condone it, but I understand it.
Yeah. I also think what you're saying about like having exercise mined out of our lives, and then now it's a leisure thing that we do, and the same thing happening with art. I think that that's really interesting. But I also think like we like the capitalism of it all. Like labor was mined out of our like lives, but we still have to do labor. It's just no longer like kind of like a group communal project. It's more of like a mandate from up top on high. And I think that that, and they talk about that in the book, like there was a study on rats and like when they had a choice, they were much happier. And so I do think that like we would be happier. Like I consider like Indigenous Americans to be like the most sophisticated society, because this idea of like living with the land, working with the land, only taking what you need, and just like being in tune, I think is actually more sophisticated than where we're at of just like mass consumption, creation.
Perpetual
Everything
growth.
Is so disconnected from, and like I want to be like, so I'm going to grow my own vegetables, but like that's not the only answer. It's like a whole systemic communal shift that needs to happen. And I think that was one of my big issues with this book, and like the final takeaway being like, we're starting to prescribe social time. We're using video games as like a treatment for this, this, and that. While I think that is a great short-term solution, I think like longer term, we need to think about, why do we mine these things that are so critical to our well-being out of our lives for the sake of capitalism, you know?
100%. No, and it's exactly when they got to the point of like, and I was curious the first time I read this, I was like, how are they going to stick the landing? Because maybe it's, I mean, it certainly is my own biases, but like everything here to me felt like in the beginning, like pretty radical, like in the sense of like, not radical, I don't know, I'm using that word too much, but basically like this isn't working with where we are in society right now, that like we've mined it out of our lives, that it doesn't fit, et cetera, et cetera. And then at the end, it's like, and you know, we'll run ads for it on TV and you can have your doctors prescribe medicine. I mean, it wasn't that bad, but it 100% gets to a point where I'm always, I will say, like looking into myself, like really cautious with my own sort of campaign around art is for everyone. I think I'm well-meaning in that, but I think it gets to a point where, and I've seen this as a kid growing up with like missionaries. So I, in my apartment complex, it was a government housing and you had to have kids to live there. So there was a ton of kids. And at the community center in our apartment complex, we'd have like churches come over and they would give us sugar cookies and grape juice if we remembered our Bibles, whatever, I can't think of the word, quote.
Verses.
Verses, there we go. It's been a long time. Anyways, and I always went because I was like, yeah, I could use the food. This is great. But I remember, I think, I don't know if it was during the time or afterwards, but someone said something like, all kids need is the Bible. All kids need. And I remember thinking it was funny because I'm like, I'm here for the sugar cookies. Like I'm here because I'm hungry. It's like the long time till dinner and you're here every Wednesday afternoon. And I think where I get cautious any conversation like this is like when it becomes like the answer is just art. When in reality, like I know this stuff helps trauma and there was a lot of great art, like the book, I think discussed trauma really beautifully. And I think that was one of my favorite parts of the book. But it's like the analogy here is like, if you're in a boat and like art will save everything is you like pulling water out of the boat with like a bucket, but then like the broken system that exploits people, that creates haves and haves not, that gives people no leisure time and like lack of connection from each other and is broken and unjust is the hole at the bottom of the boat. And it's huge. And it doesn't matter how helpful art is, and I am passionate about it. If you don't put stopping the trauma before remedying the trauma, I think it's like, it's a moot point. It actually completely neuters it entirely. And I think that's my, like, if I could be critical of the book, and I don't think they were trying to do that, but that's my big takeaway and my big criticism for anything like this.
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, like if one of the authors comes from Google, it's very solutions oriented. And it's like, hey, well, what can we do about this? And how can technology be one of the answers? And the last chapter was very much about like, technology is the answer. And I was like, it is and it isn't. And this is my big, like, my big hot take on AI is that AI is going to change everything, but not in the way we think. And it is like, actually going to like, cut through all of this clutter that we've made so that we can do more of the like digging in the soil and making art and doing nothing. And it's not going to be like this integrated existence where we go into the metaverse. It's actually going to be the opposite of like we retract from the digital life because we are too immersed in it right now because it's where commerce is the biggest and most measurable, but it's not what's best for us as humans. And I also think like when it comes to things like this, humans are going to do what humans are going to do, and like humanity will correct itself. And like I think about, for example, global warming. I was like, do people not realize that like the earth will be fine? We're going to die.
Yeah. Yeah, it's our little, like, we can only exist in this tiny bit of temperature variable that's going to be the problem, not the planet. The planet keeps cooking, you know?
Yeah, like, I was like, do they not realize that, like, it will just get too hot, we won't be able to live here, the planet will keep going, like, and all the disaster movies, you see the Earth being destroyed. And I'm like, no, it's going to be, like, annihilation, where the Earth comes back to life, and we just, like, disintegrate. Yeah. And I feel similarly about this book, and like it's like tech is the answer, and it's like, no, tech is riding the wave as humans come up with the answer. And I think you can see the ways that humans are using tech creatively to flourish. Like right now, I'm obsessed with like the Kamala Harrisification of TikTok. My whole FYP is just Kamala memes. Like she's going to be memed into the presidency. But the integration of Kamala and Brett, I think, is so interesting, and specifically the Apple dance. And I think the idea that a dance that's the song is about generational trauma and yes, healing generational trauma and examining generational trauma and wanting to run away from it all. Like that's literally yeah, what the song is about. And that's happening at a time where we're like, you know, Joe Biden stepping down, and we're dealing with a genocide that's based a few generations ago. And we have like Kamala Harris, who's like a woman, as we're talking about like reproductive rights, and it's all tied to this dance and this creative art that's happening. And I think like we can see those as like just a coincidence. Oh, it's just a poetic metaphor. But I think it's like very tied. And like, I think that this is like one example of culture healing itself through this Apple dance, the way that the earth is going to heal itself. Like, so I think where I'm at with tech is that they can either like get on board and actually build to be what humans need them to be for the next iteration, or they cannot and just continue where they've been going, and be like, no, tech is the solution to everything, and see what happens. But I don't think that that's going to work out super well.
I love that. I can't agree more about the Apple dance of it all. I even think there's something, it's funny because like I was re-listening to this book and the part about poetry and what poetry does in the brain, and it's, you know, it's satisfactory. It releases dopamine. And yes, I love poetry for that reason. Like as a kid, I was a Shel Silverstein girly. So like love a good limerick, but completely. I mean, I even think I can remember getting kind of like chills, and I will say like chills doesn't mean like a full wholehearted, like, you know, it's just an emotional response I had, but to the fact that the generational trauma apple tree lyrics, which are poetry, and Kamala Harris's quote about the coconut tree and the context that she was saying that in, about like, I think the coconut tree speech is iconic, by the way. I know we mentioned it last time, but it's, you exist all in which you live and what came before you. And it was a talk about sort of uplifting these Hispanic students as they, you know, succeed in America, and how it's important to also consider the family of these students. And that was sort of the idea of it. And the fact that like the Apple and then the Kamala Harris quote, and like, you almost like couldn't have written it, you know, when you watch a show and there's good writing, you know how you get that chill and they tied up all the loose ends and you're just like, it's the best thing ever. I had that moment. And I think what, to your point, what's exciting about it, and where I completely agree with you about the AI technology conversation. And it's funny, cause I think you either made a video about this or retweeted it or something, but anyways, you were talking about the monkey experiment where there were monkeys in a room, and this first generation of monkeys, they were climbing out, and as they started to climb out, the scientists zapped them, and so they fell off, or they didn't keep going, obviously. And then they slowly started changing out the monkeys in the room, and the monkeys who were there first knew that if you climb this rope to get out, you were going to get zapped. And as they slowly changed them out, the other monkeys who had learned that you get zapped would tell the monkeys who didn't have that prior knowledge, who thought, hey, this rope just gets out of the box, they pulled them back down. They said, no, you're going to get zapped. Well, not to say that, but that was the instinct. And what ended up happening is by the end, all of the monkeys who had been there initially were gone. And it was all the monkeys who had never even been zapped or seen anyone get zapped. And they would pull each other down. And I think what happens with the technology conversation is I even think there's power in the words. The fact that like humans will win or fix climate change with technology, I think even just the language around that says that there has to be something outside of each one of ourselves to do it. And I also think the subtext of technology is you have to be super smart or, you know, educated in STEM or, you know, have resources in order to do something about the world. But I think there's so much that defies learned helplessness when you say that the revolution will be art, will be community, will be momentum behind a meme. And I know that that sounds silly. And I know that, you know, a meme gets trivialized because it's internet and it's young and it's women and, you know, all of those things. But I think, you know, as someone who's a big believer in art, I can't help but connect all those things and feel incredibly optimistic and hopeful in a way that I hope people feel empowered to not only change their lives, but to be willing to be part of something that can change. And, you know, in any way, basically.
Yeah. And to the point about, like, I think using the monkey metaphor and AI, one of the things that they say in this book is like, one of the things that makes humans different is that we have the power to make things up and then convince each other of them. And so I think that the monkeys could convince each other that like there's we can climb this and get out and nothing's going to happen, right? Like, but AI cannot do that. AI is programmed and then it can't actually really come up with new ideas. As much as people want to believe that to be true and believe that can complete, like there's generative AI, it can only generate on what is already in existence and all that has come before.
AI is a coconut.
It cannot come up with something novel, new, and they talk about novelty and surprise and why experimentation is so important. And AI cannot do those things. So if there was an AI monkey in there, they would never get out because the AI monkey would never get rid of the idea and would never be convinced that, no, we could climb this and get out. And that's one of the dangers, I think, of like seeing AI as the end all be all of like it has the danger of stagnating us and also encoding all of our existing problems into the AI, because all it is a reflection of us, but we are very flawed as a society. And I think that encoding that into a separate thing is not the answer. Even like, I think the way I come to think about it is that I think that people think that AI is going to be the brains for us and it's going to like help us be mindless. We don't have to think about all these things because AI is doing it for us. But I actually think what AI will do is take care of like things that we don't want to think about because they don't actually matter, so that we can be more mindful and actually more intentional with like the ways that we're going about living our lives. And I think that's like one of the big issues I have with a lot of the AI like capabilities right now. They're all about like outsourcing your brain power to this thing, but it's like, no, that's not actually like what we want AI to be doing for us. We like thinking and interacting with people. And I also reposted a TikTok where it was like this girl making jokes about she was impersonating AI bro. And she was like, good news, the AI can now synthesize wine night with the girls into an email with three bullet points. And it's like, that perfectly encapsulated my issues with AI of just, it's lost the plot on why people like being people.
100%. Yeah. And it's funny because it reminds me of like, you know, a big thing that I talk about a lot with Lincoln and with other people is like a lot of the problems we're existing in right now are like, they're the things that we deserve kind of. I mean, not like literally on a human level, but it's like, you know, in the US, I think we're dealing with a lot of the karma, for lack of a better word, for not dealing with like the fact that we were started on a genocide and 400 years of, you know, enslavement and like all of these like absolute karmic terrors. And the fact that we've never apologized or had meaningful reparations and like we're living with the stagnation of those like previous things, you know. And I think with AI, it's very much a version of that, where we've created a culture, especially in white collar working class sort of circles, where there is argument between STEAM and STEM, which is honestly super trivial when you take a big step backwards from the whole thing. And they are connected, but in a world where it's I don't know if it's gendered or we just don't care or it's not as useful to capitalism or whatever, where we cut creativity out of it, of course, we're going to get an AI that can only take the average of what we're dealing with and condense it down into little points. And I think to your point where you've said something that makes you feel a little more optimistic about it is it's like it's going to gobble up those things, the jobs, the ideas where people are just presenting data points that we can use as a jumping off point to have the meaningful human thoughts, to seek novelty, to interact with each other, to have the time to do the things that are fulfilling, whether that's fulfilling because you're a human and you need to enjoy life, or it's fulfilling because it's actually enacting change and coming up with new solutions to a lot of these like bigger, scarier problems.
Yeah, totally. And I think that we're also in an era where like I said, they're so obsessed with the product and like even like movies, and you think about movies, how like everything's a sequel now and they're just rebooting old IP and just squeezing all of the life that they possibly can out of it. And I think that there's kind of a lack of appreciation for the process, like I was saying, of like the whole creative act. But I'm seeing an emergent idea among artists of honoring that process. Even that's something they talked about the book, that the continuing painting of the artist who like would paint over the painting and then paint another one and it would change over and she would take a picture. And so this idea of like, it was not about having a final painting, like you said, to hang on your wall. It was about the process of creation and destruction. There's also, I've seen a creator who does sewing, but she puts ink on her hands. Have you seen this?
No.
So she'll be like sewing products, but while she has ink on, so like a shirt, and then you see the basically her fingerprints all over the garment and that it was quote unquote handmade. And like you can love see it. The labor that goes into that. There's also the hug vases. Have you seen this trend yes. that people are doing yeah. where they like hug each other and like capture the hug in a vase? Mm. There's also that potter who makes like a whole thing of things and then like knocks them over and they all fall. Yeah. And so just like I'm seeing that artists in, I think, kind of retaliation to this like AI thing that's going to steal your work mm-hmm. are saying like, steal this. How can you steal this process, this human process that I've created? And so, like I said, culture will heal itself. It's mm-hmm. just a matter of technology is going to be part of the conversation or not, and like where it's going to fit in. But AI is not going to replace human creativity. And I know that that's going to be the truth, but I'm just curious how long this era of stagnation is going to last.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I love that. And I think that's, it's a fascinating because like whenever there was this initial sort of, so social media always gets criticized because it's like newer and institutions don't typically like it. It's kind of an old trite conversation. But, a lot of people who worked in museums and like wrote blogs and, part of the art institution, when there was like process videos starting to go viral, and I'm even thinking like as recent as like 5-10 years ago, or like it's been a while, but there was a lot of criticism of like, that's only gaining popularity because of the process. And, the older institution of the art world, all the way from a Christie's to your local gallery, there's like a big focus on like, can you sell it? Does this have market resale value? Blah, blah, blah. And that still dictates the art world. And I remember feeling really like put off by that because I'm like, well, the process is really cool. And now you can share it with people. And I kind of don't understand a lot of the criticisms, but it's funny because it took AI, I think, being so extreme to push the conversation to like, no, in some of these cases, like the process is the whole point. It's not the ability to sell it. Like I had like a little micro series I did with like one wood panel where I just kept painting like, for lack of a better term, like garbage on it, like just like random memes and like moments and like a ketchup packet, just like dumb stuff. But I kept painting over it and it would get gloopier and people could sort of watch it happen. And actually that was a bit of an exercise for me because instead of keeping a journal, I just make little paintings as though they're journal studies, but then I can sell them. And a lot of that's because like I needed to pay my bills, but it was very like I had made it to a point where it wasn't quite so scarce. And so I could just like throw away an hour or two of work and paint over it like a week later. And it was very cathartic. And I think that that's, I'm trying to wrap it up a little bit here, but I think that's what is exciting about it. And I think that's going to be a big point that ushers in sort of this creative movement where everyone feels able to paint because the focus is less the product and it's more just the process. Like you are the slab of clay as much as whatever you're making. Like it's making you a different person. It's making you change. It's making you think differently. It's giving you more empathy and peace and whatever, gestures towards the book you want out of it, neurologically speaking anyways.
Yeah, and they talk about that. I think one of the last chapters, chapter 7, is creating community. I have created a craft club. Like, that's something that I do. You are a community builder around the arts as well. And
Love it.
I think we've both seen like the positive impact that that can have in people's lives, just like, ourselves. And like, if this was something that we as a society like actually put our minds to and like actually dedicated some time to, I think could be super healing and really restorative. And I think it's happening. I feel like we send each other the girlies on TikTok all the time doing their craft clubs. And every time I just get so happy that like it's a thing that people are doing, where because it's like the point is not to have like the fridge magnets. It's to spend the afternoon making the fridge magnets with your friends. And I feel like people are starting to realize that and the value that creativity can bring to their lives and their well-being. And I think this book was like a really good articulation of that, that will speak to the capitalists as well as the art lovers.
Yes, I love it. Well said. And that's, I think that's, yeah, the power of the book is it kind of can speak to anyone. You can, because it is so data heavy, luckily, there's like a lot of room for interpretation to your initial point of this whole conversation. But yeah, I recommend it to anyone. And if anyone's reading this, like if you have anyone in your life that, like, I don't know, holds like a little candle for a creative act, but maybe they're like drinking the full like AI Kool-Aid, or they're just like really a data point person. I know people in my life who are like this. Like, I would definitely recommend the book for them. So I hope to see more people reading, recommending this book, and more importantly, mining stuff out of it. I'm thinking about making a whole series, like chapter by chapter. Honestly, I'm so inspired.
Honestly, you should. It was really good, and I'll comment because I have lots to say, and like I would love to revisit some of the ideas in this book.
100%. Thank you, Megan, so much for being here. As always, so grateful for
Course.
all your insights. I'll be thinking about all the things you said for weeks. Everyone, thank you for reading the book or listening to the podcast or both. Next month, we'll be listening to Get the Picture by Bianca Bosker, which is good because I think it kind of straddles the line between the last two books we read, where like last month's was kind of like not sad, but just like, I don't know, grim. This one was very data focused, but hopeful. And I think the next book is like fully grounded in reality in a way that's like hilarious and I think a very entertaining read. So if you're not a nonfiction girly, don't worry. Next month is more fun. And yeah, thank you again. I'll talk to you next month. Everyone, let me know how you like the book. I would love to hear your thoughts as always. And I'll talk to you in a month.
Bye. Thank you for
Bye.
having me.
Yeah, thank you, Megan.
Thank you so much for listening and thank you for being here. I wanted to also encourage you guys to leave a review. The feedback is incredibly helpful. And if you leave a review, I will read your handle or your name on the following week's episode. Take care, y'all, and happy creating.